Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, August 10th. Welcome, friends, to the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. As government programs go, Head Start is one of the more visible.
Yeah.
In that you probably know what Head Start is, but if you don't, I'll explain. Mm-hmm. Head Start is a program funded by the federal government that provides free childcare, early childhood education to low-income families. It's been around for over 60 years. Yeah. It has its critics, especially on the right side of the aisle, folks who think it's ineffective, it costs too much. And there have been conservatives for many years who have wanted to phase it out or eliminate it. That's not what's happening right now, but perhaps it could be on the road to a major overhaul or major changes, because the federal government right now is proposing some new rules that would vastly reduce the amount of regulations that govern Head Start. Talking about things like mandated class sizes, physical health screenings, on and on and on. And that power would go to the states instead of resting with the federal government. So today in the program, we're going to talk about whether that's a good thing, because there are a lot of regulations, 133 pages of regulations that govern Head Start. Is it a good thing to cut back some of this red tape, or will it ultimately reduce the quality and effectiveness of Head Start? Again, a pillar of the Great Society anti-poverty effort 60 years ago. So we're going to talk with a couple folks, one a Head Start teacher, one a researcher who looks into early childhood education. And then at the end of the show, a little coda at the end, we're going to look at some of the broader efforts that the Trump administration has undertaken to whittle down the Department of Education in general. So big picture, we're looking at the role of the federal government in education today. And we're asking, what do you think that role should be? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, and some people might think, look, there is a lot of red tape, but they still might want the government to do something. Love to hear from you, 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org. And like always, we have our trio of local news stories.
Got to start with the trio.
Yeah. First up, Delaware County residents are set to vote on a referendum this November that developers say could make the county's housing shortage worse. The referendum would give the county the ability to spend up to $120 million through a bond purchase to preserve and improve open space. According to the Philadelphia Business Journal, the proposal was met with mixed reaction at the July 16th County Council meeting. Supporters say it'll keep and enhance the green space around the county, which people say has dwindled over the years. And critics, though, say it'll be a burden on taxpayers, because $120 million bond, that's expensive. And also those in real estate, they say it would make it harder to develop new properties and drive up costs. Now, all of this comes just as a developer county dispute over 213 Delco Woods property is up for appeal. And we talked about this in a live event that we had back in Delco a while back. Mm-hmm. But let me bring you up to speed. In 2021, Delaware County took Delco Woods by eminent domain. They paid developers and the Archdiocese $24 million for that property when a valuation came back showing that it was worth more than double that. Delco has appealed that valuation, and that valuation remains heavily contested. But a lot of folks have asked whether this request for up to $120 million in bonds is connected to that Delco Woods battle. And a Delaware County Council Vice Chair, Christine Reuther, said they are separate. But if the referendum were to pass, that money would be used to finish paying for Delco Woods. So they also said that, look, this is going to be used, this money, if it passes, if the voters approve it, it'll be used to help with infrastructure like stormwater drains and all kinds of stuff. But, Delaware County does have a housing shortage, Avi. I mean, 15,000 new units need to be developed over the next 5 years if they're going to account for growth and make up for the shortfall.
Mm. Well, this is the eternal debate in communities all over the country. Open space versus development, development versus open space. And look, these are sort of very direct trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
Without new housing somewhere, the cost of housing goes up. And particularly a place like Delaware County, where there's lots of access to opportunity, to jobs, to education. And so Delaware County is, you know, it's mostly an inner ring suburb. That said, people move to the suburbs for space, for a little bit of fresh air, to space to stretch out. And so part of the appeal of these communities is the fact that there's some greenery and open space that exists. And so it's an interesting little sort of local example of the fight that's just playing out all over the country constantly. And it seems like we're always locked in this battle.
And then it's like so many young people, they need places. People need places to live.
Sure do.
And it's like no one has a place to live now. You know, people live. We heard, you know, even on this air, like people, you know, middle age, 30 some year old kids living with their parents because there's no place to go. So
story number two.
Yeah.
A Philadelphia lawmaker wants to ban even the possibility of driverless SEPTA buses. Now, to be clear, no such buses exist yet. But with robo-taxis on the verge of coming to Philly, State Rep Ben Waxman says now is the time to ban driverless buses. Nice story by Billy Penn's Mayor Rindy on this legislation and really the larger debate around the topic of automated public transit, because this debate is barreling toward us. Waxman's bill would require any vehicle weighing 10,000 plus pounds to have a licensed driver on board, even if the vehicle is using automated technology. He says this bill would cover buses and trolleys, not subway trains, by the way. Why would they do this? Well, Waxman and union officials worry about job losses, right? If the bus doesn't need a driver, then you don't have to pay a driver to be on the bus. Waxman also cited possible safety concerns with the technology. And more broadly, there's just a debate about even how feasible all of this is, because having a machine operate a bus in a city with lots of unpredictability and the fact that drivers do more than just drive the bus, like they help people with disabilities get on and off. Like, how could you automate all of this? And there is genuine debate among experts about how close this technology would even be.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I just think about safety on buses. Like you said, just having a human presence on the bus makes the buses safer. And I remember like a time when I was in college on a bus and I was being harassed, and it was literally the bus driver who stepped in and made the harasser get off the bus. Sure. And I think about what would that have been if there was no one of authority there and everybody else is kind of like avoiding conflict. How safe would the bus be? So, you know, and then if there's an emergency, you kind of need someone who has emergency protocols, you know, who can direct folks around, because stuff does happen. So very interesting. Also, I thought it was interesting that trains and subways not part of this bill. So it seems like it, you know, that would be okay, but those are jobs too. So,
right. Those are, you know, equally jobs.
Yeah.
And it also was interesting to me, one note in the story, you should read it, by the way, it's up at Billy Penn right now. There was an expert who thought like automated bus technology was very feasible within the next 10 years, but also said that it might not be all that money saving just because of the amount of money you'd have to spend on the technology up front, but also the computing power to run it. Not that it would be as much as paying a person, but maybe the savings wouldn't be all that great, which was surprising.
Because all the detours, things happen every single day and you need great technology for that.
Sure. Yeah. Anyways, it's a fascinating sort of like futuristic what if to think about.
Yes.
Story number three. This is something that's happening in the present day. Thank God.
Yes. A new Fishtown pizza spot is making headlines with pie toppings that include shrimp and grits, oxtails, and collard greens, and jerk chicken. I'm wondering about how you put grits on pizza, but I digress. The new spot is called In Crust We Trust. It's located near Frankfort and Richmond across from the Fillmore, and it's owned by first-time restaurateur Anya Wilson Worley. The 25-year-old's vision is to combine pizza with Black culinary tradition.
25 and owns a restaurant?
25, yes. Wow. Hence, she has a pizza called The John, which has fried chicken, buffalo sauce, mozzarella, and blue cheese. There's also a pizza with a cornbread crust and another one with watermelon barbecue sauce.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
And I should mention that Wilson Worley is the oldest daughter of Felicia Wilson. And if that name rings a bell, Felicia is the founder of the Amina Hospitality Group, which owns nearly a half dozen restaurants in the city, including Amina, Ivana, Black Hen, among others.
So it's like a restaurant dynasty now.
It
is. Okay, interesting.
And daughter Anya went to college to actually become a doctor and originally thought she would never work in restaurants, but came home after college to help mom out, got bit by the bug. And she says In Crust We Trust is totally her concept, although mom, of course, is mentoring her. But it's very interesting. They sell wings, salads, desserts. They have a gelato and a sweet potato cheesecake custard on the menu.
Sure. Sounds great.
So how do you think grits on pizza work?
I don't understand. They're serving grits on. What is the grits?
Shrimp and grits. Yeah.
That's one of the pizzas.
That's one of the pizzas.
Sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not? You can put anything on a pizza, I suppose.
It's one of the great conveyors of flavor ever invented by humanity. Thank God for the Neapolitans. Yes, I did, absolutely. I'm not very orthodox about what should be on a pizza. I care more about the amount of topping. Like, I don't like it when they put too much on there because then the pizza starts to droop.
Yeah, and then you need a good crust too. Crust and topping.
I'm just like, it's about moderation with the toppings. Mm-hmm. Too much is too much. And if I end up having to eat it with a fork because it's all drooping off,
then that's not
what I want. So if it's the right amount of shrimp and grits, then I'm game.
Yeah. I want to taste
the shrimp. Are people against it?
And I want to taste the grit.
What would be the problem?
I don't think it would be a problem. I'm just in my mind thinking, I guess you got to go and Crust We Trust to check it out.
I trust crust, apparently.
Yeah.
I have a lot of trust.
Yeah. And we'll be talking about the Department of Education and Head Start coming up. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Head Start is a federally funded early childhood education program that serves 700,000 low-income children around the country, 30,000 right here in Pennsylvania. Last week, the Trump administration proposed new rules that it says will vastly expand the program while saving billions. It would cut over 100 pages of requirements for things like small class sizes, medical, dental, and disability screenings, and full-day care. And it would give states the power to set new standards.
Yeah, this proposal has raised alarms for advocates and education experts who argue it will gut the program, reducing its ability to help vulnerable children and families. But for years, conservative critics have gone after Head Start, questioning the program's effectiveness. Eliminating it was part of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, which has guided a lot of White House policy.
So this hour, we're going to talk about Head Start, its impact, its future, and how these changes would affect the hundreds of thousands of families it serves. And later in the hour, stay tuned, because we're going to talk about the Department of Education and White House efforts to dismantle it. But first, let me introduce our guests. With us in studio, we have Norma Bell. She's a Head Start teacher at the Children's Village that's located just around the corner from us. Norma, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. We're also glad to have by Zoom Stephen Barnett, Board of Governors professor and the founding director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. Stephen Barnett, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere. What do you think should be the role of the federal government in education? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube and Facebook, hello. You can put your comments in the live chat.
So Stephen Barnett, wanted to start with you. 133 pages of federal requirements around Head Start. I think some folks listening out there would think 133 sounds like a lot of pages. Perhaps it's worth trimming that down. What about this latest effort from the Trump administration do you think is potentially helpful? And what do you think is potentially harmful?
Well, I think you and everybody else who thinks like that is right. Yeah, we don't need 133 pages. Vastly reduce them. That's great. Don't micromanage Head Start. Let professionals do their job. Unfortunately, there's a number of provisions in the proposals that don't really have anything to do with reducing micromanagement compliance burden. In fact, what they do is make Head Start's job much harder, if not impossible. And that's where the problem comes in.
And what are those things that would make the job harder?
Well, reducing the other way around, it's increasing the number of kids in a classroom to childcare ratios. Those are intended by states to keep kids safe, not for a school readiness program that's supposed to break the cycle of poverty. That's what the current ratios are for. And if you want to align with states, well, states have policies for their school readiness programs. That's not the childcare standards. They're all the same as Head Start. Well, I shouldn't say they're all, but most of them are the same as Head Start or more restrictive than what Head Start requires. So this is moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah. And so, Norma, thank you so much for being here in studio
Yes.
with us. So I want you to sort of take us inside of a classroom, like the one where you work, and just tell us a little bit about how it functions. And then I want you to give reaction to the recently announced changes.
Well, what he just said about increasing child ratios, that is very detrimental. It will cause teacher burnout. I've been a Head Start teacher since 2000 when the program was instituted at Children's Village. My classroom is a very diverse classroom. I have bilingual, trilingual students in my classroom. It's a wonderful, warm environment. It's very welcoming. We focus on developing the relationships not only with our children, but with our families we serve. The classroom is labeled with both English and Mandarin because most of my students are Mandarin speaking. We have interest areas. We have cozy areas for children when they're going through some emotional distress upon arrival. We have a library. Children can sit in a loft and enjoy books. We have just a lot of learning equipment and toys and games that are developmentally appropriate for the 3, 4, and 5-year-old students that we serve.
And so, talk about how, what is the children to teacher ratio now? And then, how would the recently announced changes, and I think English only is one of
Oh,
the
that's
requirements. So how would your classroom change under these new proposed rules?
Well, it would definitely affect the learning of the students because right now it's 10 to 1. All right. And I'm telling you, that's manageable, right?
It's a lot, but it's
It's a
manageable.
lot, but it's manageable. I mean, we make it happen. In terms of the English only component of this whole deregulation thing, we have a lot of students that are not English speaking, but they speak Mandarin, Cantonese, Vietnamese. Now, I'm not fluent in Mandarin, but I know phrases that I can communicate with my students that way. I have books in a classroom that reflects their culture. I mean, if we're going to say English only, what about culturally responsive teaching? What about accepting the cultures that are in your classroom? It would affect that where parents might not feel, hey, this is not the place for my child, you know?
Yeah, and I wanted to maybe broaden out a little bit. Stephen Barnett, what distinguishes Head Start from other early child care programs? Like, what are the hallmarks of what make it different? It's the student teacher ratios, I imagine. That's one of the prongs that makes it different. Are there other things that make it substantially different than a typical preschool that you might send your kid to?
Yeah, well, part of the issue is typical preschool, right? So since Head Start was founded, states and local government have begun to provide programs like Head Start, right, that are aimed at school readiness, preparing kids to succeed in school and life. And many of those look like Head Start. They have strong teachers, strong supports to help teachers do a good job in the classroom, the kinds of things that you just heard about in this Head Start program. That's very different from what we typically provide in many childcare programs, where the goal is what's the least we can do to keep kids safe? Now, that's not desirable, it's not everywhere, but that's the standards they're talking about aligning Head Start with. And that's one of the major problems here. Head Start has resources now. And one of the things that I think most people don't understand is, especially over the last 25 years, there's been very bipartisan movement in Congress, by the George W. Bush administration, by the Obama administration, to improve the resources Head Start has, strengthen the program, increase the hours, so you can do the key thing. And that key thing is individualizing, one-on-one, small groups, intentional teaching to support learning and development of each child in the classroom.
What about the argument that you could serve more kids mm-hmm. by changing the student-teacher ratios? I mean, mathematically, I would think that is like factually true.
But two problems with that. You're not delivering the service, right? It's child development. Once you make it more difficult for teachers to do that one-on-one intensive relationship building, understanding, knowledge building with the child, is not the same program.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not increasing, but as you just heard, if we put more kids in the classroom, Head Start already has trouble hiring teachers for all of the classrooms because the job is too hard for the pay that's provided. And the administration is making both of those things more difficult with the prior proposed rule.
I want to ask you both this question, and Stephen, I want you to get this, and then Norma, I want you to chime in as well. At what point does Head Start stop being early education and essentially become a child care, like a babysitting service? Like, if you look at what the cuts have been made, And I think the argument that both of you are making is that these cuts will fundamentally change the nature of the service provided. So I'm trying to figure out, Stephen, where that line is. And then Norma, I'd love to hear you chime in. Like, where is that line in your mind?
Well, certainly the line is crossed here. Mm-hmm. In some states, the ratio is 1:18 for 4-year-olds.
Yeah.
So that's 36 children in the classroom. That's not going to work.
And we're talking about 3 and 4-year-olds here. Go right ahead, mm-hmm. Norma, and chime in on that. Where in your mind, as an early childhood educator, does the line cross where you just cannot effectively perform the service?
You're talking about causing anxiety and stress with the increase. I can't even imagine that at this point, because Head Start is such a phenomenal program. You know, these cuts will affect wraparound services for our students, healthcare, parents who want to go back to school, you know, they need childcare. When he just said 18 students, 18-1 in some states. I can't imagine that for 4-year-olds. That is not providing high quality early childhood education. Mm-hmm.
Let me read this comment from Vicky in Westchester, who says, "My son was able to attend a Head Start in the early 70s. If it hadn't been for that, we might have starved. No one would give me a job if I was relying on babysitters. When I got him into the program, I got hired the day after he started. Today, it's the cost of childcare that's the impediment. Today, he's a healthy man who's done well in life." Thank you for that story, Vicky in Westchester. Mm-hmm. You talked about some of the wraparound services, Norma Bell, mm-hmm. and some of these new rules would roll back requirements around like medical screenings, the fact that children have to brush their teeth after every single meal. That's a requirement of Head Start. Are there requirements? And are there wraparound service requirements that you feel are onerous, that you feel like you could do without, or if I could take that time and invest it elsewhere, it would be better for the program?
I couldn't say that. We have a nurse that comes on site. We have a dentist. The children are provided nutritional meals. They're provided screenings for developmental delays.
How does that help? Give people an example of how that helps a child.
Well, it helps them to be able to kind of like be able to adjust into a classroom. I mean, if they have therapists there, they assist them with tasks and learning to follow directions. Mm-hmm. Brushing teeth. Come on now, we want students to do
sure.
that.
But some arguments would be, Norma, that these are the types of things that could be left to parents, right? That is the duty of parents, not necessarily of the government. What's your response to that?
Well, we're talking about low income families. We're talking about families. I mean, and with the economy now, they have to work. I have children. Our program opens up at 6:30 in the morning. I have students at 6:30. I arrive at work at 7. I have a half a classroom of students, myself and another teacher. It's important. I mean, you want children to develop, you know, basic skills. You want them to, parents don't have time to do this. They have to work. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is part of what we do.
Yeah.
They eat breakfast in the morning. They brush their teeth after breakfast. We have instruction, our morning meeting. We do small groups. We have read alouds. We do music. We take them to the park. We have a rooftop deck. We have so many resources. Like right now, the performance standards now, they could just stay the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need these changes.
Let me get the phone number out there again. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We're talking about some proposed changes to Head Start right now. Let me read this comment from Jean on Facebook, who says, Head Start is much more than an educational program. I was a volunteer aide and saw how amazing the results were. One of the goals of Project 2025 is to destroy it. Sid on Facebook says, Head Start should be fully funded. In fact, there should be a national curriculum for every grade with monetary incentives for achieving benchmarks. Our students are falling behind. Thank you, Sid and Jean, for those comments. Stephen, I have heard people make the argument that the greatest measurable impact of Head Start is the exact thing that Vicky, our commenter, laid out earlier, which is that it allows the parents to go into the workforce and earn money and provide stability for the family. If that is the case, then one could argue that just having more seats is achieving the goal, because you're just allowing more parents that coverage to enter the workforce. And if that's the thing that has the biggest impact, then do more of that, even at the expense of the quality of the care. What would you say to that argument?
I'd say the argument's almost right. So yes, it's a benefit if you help parents work, but the struggle parents have is not finding cheap childcare that's not good for their kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's finding affordable programs that support their children's development. That's the problem. So making it something that's not good for kids that we could warehouse their children while they work. No, that's not what parents need. And it's not what parents want. And they won't pick it. And that's the biggest flaw.
Even if it was free, you still think it would be that parents would not opt for it.
Absolutely not. They want the best for their kids.
Yeah. And let me ask you this. I mean, critics of Head Start have long pointed to a major federal impact study that found initial school readiness benefits, but relatively few significant differences between Head Start participants and a control group by later elementary grades. I want you to comment on that. The arguments that, you know what, Head Start, people like it, but it's not as effective as, you know, people think it is. Stephen. Well,
absolutely. In 2000, when those kids went to Head Start, it was not as effective as we would like. And that's why the 2007 reauthorization under George W. Bush, unanimously approved by Congress, made major changes. That's why the Obama administration and others have pushed, we need to pay teachers more. We need more hours per day, per year. This whole set of improvements.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And this is just moving. So, yes, but we need to move in the direction of strengthening Head Start, as we've been doing for the last 25 years since that study.
And
not in the opposite direction and give up.
And Norma, you've been a part of this program. You worked in this program since 2000,
mm-hmm.
when this study came out, when this study started, should I say. And so I want you to talk about how you've seen the program change. And do you believe it's become more effective?
Well, I would say it's become more effective because with the performance standards, one thing that I can say Head Start is very valuable to me as a teacher is we provide home visits,
mm-hmm.
twice a year. And I write goals for students. I give parents strategies that they can use in a home. I take books. I show them how to do read alouds. I play games with families. It really builds that relationship, and it pulls the parent in to really realize the importance of early childhood education. They get to see what we do in the classroom mm-hmm. to improve the quality of our students. You know, when it started out, you know, I was just impressed with Head Start. I mean, I known yeah. about Head Start even when it first began.
Were you working in another early childhood
I worked before? In an early childhood program that did not have Head Start.
What was the, like, what was the sort of difference between the two?
It was
two?
A big difference.
Big difference.
It was, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Was it easier to teach in the Head Start setting?
No, it was
setting?
Not.
It wasn't interesting.
It was easier in the Head Start setting yeah. to teach than,
and why?
Than in the prior, yeah.
Why, and why was the, what was the difference maker, do you think?
I would say the administration.
Yeah.
The families. I mean, it was like babysitting.
Yeah.
It was like babysitting.
And do you see that? So it was like babysitting in the non-Head Start.
In the non-Head Start. Yes. And, you know, I only can speak from my experience as a Head Start teacher. My main goal is to develop a partnership with my families from the beginning when mm-hmm. they start. So even my students that I have now, I have a great rapport. You know, I greet my students in the morning. I talk to my parents. I provide, we have a classroom dojo that we've been using since the pandemic, where I'm able to chat with parents throughout the yeah. day and show them. They get to see every day what we're doing in the classroom so that they can reinforce things at home. Head Start, yeah. It's awesome. I don't see any changes to really be made as an educator.
Yeah, and Melanie says Head Start is a comprehensive program to support the yes. child and family. The program
is
designed to give kids a great start. Slashing the requirements will not give this great start. Investing in children now saves money later. And I guess my quick follow-up to you, Norma, is there, do you see there being, because Stephen talked about there was red tape. Have you as a educator seen that red tape? Micromanagement from the federal government, or do you not feel that? Are you insulated from that?
I say I'm insulated from mm-hmm. that because my director is a she is an advocate for early childhood development, and she fights for our families and our children. So yeah. I never had to deal with the red tape. And as I said before about home visit, it really brings that connection between the families and educators. I wish everyone could be a part of Head Start.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You think you'd still be working in this space if you weren't in Head Start? You think you would have burned out working in like the type of setting you were in before?
Well, I was burnt out.
You were burnt out.
I was burnt out, and I left because I was wearing many hats at the program, and I took a year off. Wow. I said I needed a break, mm-hmm. you know.
But you've been doing Head Start for a long time, so that suggests that it's sustainable for you.
It is sustainable, and I see the benefits. You know, my students come back and visit me years later. Oh. You know, and they say,
"Tell
hey,
us
Ms.
about
Norma.
One." Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I have one student, one of my Head Start students. Right now, she lives in New York. When she, you know, her parents was really adamant about her being a doctor. And she used to draw all the time. She liked sketching and things like that. And I really allowed her to pursue that, you know. And she said, you know what, out of all the teachers I ever had, you saw my worth, you know, my interest, my passion. And she's she has an art studio.
Mm. Wow.
So, I mean.
You got to see the whole process.
I get a lot of students that come back and visit. So, that's the reward of teaching.
Yeah.
The reward of teaching. So.
Let me bring in a caller. This is Eileen from Hatfield who's on the line. Eileen, you're on Studio 2. What are your thoughts on Head Start and early childhood education?
My major thought is that every penny spent on early childhood education saves money later on. This was also just referred to. But we have to look at a big picture. We can't just look at early childhood education as a finite thing in itself. I just want to also note that I have been in the field for 45 years. I'm retired now. But so I have seen generations come through. And you can't underestimate the value of relationships. Human beings learn best through relationships. And if you have classes with too many children, there cannot be a relationship. Even 18 in a classroom in elementary school, middle school, and even high school are too many for relationships. Yeah. I have direct experience with someone who in his student teaching had two different ratios in teaching high school. One was in a school for gifted children in New York, where it was a 1-to-15 relationship ratio. And those kids did very well. Then this teacher went to an inner city school where there were 35 kids in a class for one teacher. There was no way to have relationships there. And anyone just thinking about it can see that those gifted children could have withstood, if they had to, a 30-to-1 relationship.
Understood.
And the other students were the ones who needed those relationships in order to learn.
Right. Thank you so much, Eileen.
Thank you,
Eileen. We are coming up at the end of the segment, so I just want to squeeze in one more question. You know, according to Education Next, Head Start in fiscal year 2023 served about 550,000 children at a cost of $12,000 per child. Early Head Start, about $19,000 per child. What's the argument, the economic argument, Stephen Barnett, that the federal government recoups its investment in Head Start?
Well, those aren't big numbers, right? I've done multiple benefit cost analysis on programs that cost much more than that per child. And the economic benefits from even modest changes in children's school success, so they don't fail, they don't repeat a grade, they don't go on to get involved in delinquency and crime, they make more money as adults, they're healthier as adults, right? When you add all of that up, it dwarfs the costs of these programs. So if we make bad decisions about programs like Head Start, underinvest in them, it's actually going to cost us money in the long run.
Well, that's the final word from Stephen Barnett, who is the Board of Governors professor and founder and senior co-director of the National Institute for Early Education at Rutgers University. Stephen Barnett, thanks for joining us today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And let me also thank Norma Bell, Head Start teacher at the Children's Village, just around the corner from us here in Old City. Norma, thanks for taking a break from your day to visit us here at Studio 2.
I have to get back to my students.
Yes, and coming up next, though, we're going to zoom out a little bit and talk about some of the broader changes that have been made to the Department of Education under the Trump administration. We have a reporter who's going to help us walk through it all, and we'd love to hear from you. What do you think should be the role of the federal government in education? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@why.org. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Before we get back to our conversation about Head Start and federal education policy under the Trump administration, we've got to shout out our next Studio 2 on the Road event. Philadelphia is a city of firsts, and coming up Tuesday, August 25th, live from noon to 1, we'll be at America's first official hospital.
That's right. We'll, using that term loosely, we'll be at the newly opened Pennsylvania Hospital Museum to talk about 275 years of medical history and the groundbreaking idea advanced by Benjamin Franklin that healthcare should be for everyone, not just those who can afford it.
Yeah, after our live broadcast, attendees will be able to tour the new museum and see the first medical library and the first surgical amphitheater. Again, it's Tuesday, August 25th from noon to 1. It's a free event, but you need to register at whyy.org/events, and I hope to see you there.
First surgical amphitheater. I am quite curious about that.
I think I would go to one of those, by the way. Like, I think that I would have gone to one of those. Anyway.
Conversation for another day. Yes. Now back to our conversation about federal education policy. Mm-hmm. We wanted to find out what's been happening over the last year since the president signed an executive order dismantling the Department of Education. So to walk us through all of that, we have called up Erica Meltzer, national editor of Chalkbeat. Erica, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think should be the role of the federal government in education? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook viewers, you can comment in the live chat. And Erica, before we go into what changes have been made, for folks who may not know, can you just tell us, before the Trump administration came in, what did the Department of Education actually do?
No, this is a great question because I think it's not very well understood. The Department of Education has really important roles in data collection and promoting research about what works well in education. They have a really important role in civil rights enforcement. They're sort of the backstop when students are not being treated well in schools and they're not able to get recourse locally. And they provide important funding, especially for students with disabilities and for high poverty school districts. But the large majority of education decisions have always been made at the state and local level. What your child experiences in the classroom is largely set at the state legislature, or even more so by your local school board.
So it sounds like if, you know, an administration were to sort of dismantle or whittle down the Department of Ed, it wouldn't have a huge impact. Or am I wrong here? Tell me what the Trump administration has done and sort of, you know, counter that argument.
Yeah, so conservatives for a long time have felt that that the federal role is too large. They disagree with some of these large funding programs. They think that particularly the way the Obama and Biden administration pursued civil rights enforcement represented federal overreach, particularly when it came to supporting the rights of LGBTQ students. It is important sort of to put all of that in context, is that one of the most important federal roles in education actually goes back to the civil rights movement and school desegregation. And so when we talk about whether the federal role is too large, whether we're imposing on local communities, that is sort of the long historical arc of that conversation. At the same time, we used to not have a federal official standalone Department of Education, and we still had the federal government pursuing civil rights enforcement. And so I think it's a little complicated, but you need to think about sort of the larger goals of this administration in terms of enforcing civil rights in a way that is really focused on discrimination against white students or white teachers, really focused on whether transgender students, which bathrooms they use, as opposed to the historical focus of Title IX on sexual violence, sexual harassment opportunities for women. There's sort of a larger political project here that dismantling the Department of Education is in service to that project. And so that's going to shape how this looks on the ground. And so we've seen big disruptions to funding, grants that have been abruptly canceled. Sometimes they've been restored through litigation, through lawsuits. We've seen disruptions in, or big changes in, how civil rights are enforced. But in terms of, like, what is a teacher doing in the classroom, it does not have that much impact.
Yeah, so let's maybe go through what is still happening and what's actually changed. So, like, for instance, the money that the federal government gives to schools serving students with lots of low-income students, that kind of pass-through money, that money's still being passed through, right? There's the Title I money, that's still going to the schools. And is it still going, routing through the Department of Education?
Yeah, they've moved K-12 technically under the Department of Labor, but it's sort of a whole process. It's not completely done yet. But yeah, the Title I money is still, you know, going out the door, going to school districts. They have, on some other grant programs that are smaller grant programs, allowed some states to do a certain amount of consolidation as sort of an experiment. And we have heard on, not so much on Title I, but on some other programs, that some of the funding has been a little bit disrupted as it's gone to the Department of Labor. Not everything's been completely smooth as they transition these different systems.
And what about funding and support for special education students? Is that still happening under the auspices of the DOE? Is it happening somewhere else in the federal government, not happening at all? What's the status there?
Technically, right now, it's still under the Department of Education. They just recently, earlier this summer, announced that special education was going to be moving to Health and Human Services, which raised a lot of concerns. Like, advocates are almost universally opposed to this change. But that's like the actual implementation of these interagency agreements is kind of a slow process. And I should also say, it's actually been very difficult to get clear information about what's happening with these agreements. Like, Congress has repeatedly asked for information, and what we hear is that they've gotten very little information. If you ask the administration, will say everything's going smoothly. We do sometimes hear from school districts that there's certain disruptions, but a lot of this federal money goes out in a chunk in the fall. It's called, what's called forward funding. And so we'll see as we go through this fiscal year, what kinds of impacts we see.
And you mentioned that the changes of the focus of the investigations. And I wanted to sort of touch on that, but also the fact that I want to talk about the impact of sort of dispersing the different duties and responsibilities that the Department of Education had into these other agencies. How has that impacted the flow and the work that the DOE has historically done?
Advocates are really concerned that that there just won't be as much communication and coordination. And the other thing to keep in mind is, even as they've dispersed these duties, they've also laid off a very large number of staff. And so sometimes the people who did that work are just not there anymore. Some employees have been sort of assigned to other departments. And so in those cases, you would have the same contact. I think what we hear pretty consistently is that it's just a lot harder to get questions answered, or you don't know who to ask. Whereas before, if you had a question, you could ask. Yeah, and I think the other thing is, the administration will say that we're doing this to make services more efficient, to better align, we talk about people with disabilities, you know, they start out as infants who might get services through Health and Human Services. And then as adults, they might have other needs. And so we're going to move special education to Health and Human Services. At the same time, Project 2025, which was the Heritage Foundation's blueprint for this administration, talks about completely eliminating the federal role in education. And so it's a little bit of a disconnect between, we're going to make this more efficient, but this long-term goal is that this function completely goes away. And then that really just leaves people, if they have a problem, they're limited to what is available in their state to pursue their rights. And a lot of state education departments don't have a robust system to take on these responsibilities, because historically they have not had to.
On the whole, would you say that what you're hearing from advocates, activists, people who are concerned, is more like forward looking, like, we are concerned this could cause X, Y, and Z? Or are they coming to you and saying, we're seeing demonstrable impacts on vulnerable populations? Like, we're seeing, like, we have demonstrated sort of cases of the way this is impacting the people who are supposed to receive this money, this support, this service.
A lot of the concern is forward looking, but we do hear from particularly people who help represent people who have civil rights complaints about their school district, that they feel like school districts are not as responsive to those complaints because
they're not scared the feds will come over them.
Yeah. And I think we're also seeing, for example, schools sort of roll back certain diversity initiatives in like a, sometimes in a preemptive compliance, like they haven't been targeted yet for these policies, but they don't want to be targeted or told they're going to lose funding. And so they think it's just, or sometimes they keep doing the same thing, but they rename it. There's been a massive renaming of diversity initiatives to very generic names.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, is there any thought, and we only have about a minute and a half left, as to whether states will sort of step up? Because one of the things you talked about was that, look, states historically have not had to deal with certain things because they could rely on the federal government to fill the void. And now that the federal government is sort of stepping back, have you seen any efforts by states to sort of fill that gap?
Particularly in Democratic-led states, we have seen legislation to beef up the civil rights function of state education departments, to add additional recourse or enforcement capabilities. But this is an expensive undertaking. A lot of states are under a lot of budget pressure right now. Some of this is related to the Trump administration's One Big Beautiful Bill, because it shifted a lot of healthcare costs to the states. But we're seeing just, I think, a much greater patchwork that Republican-led states that are more aligned with these efforts, they're also decentralizing at the state level down to the locals. And so students' rights are going to become more variable depending on where they live.
Well, thank you so much for your insights this hour, Erica Meltzer, national editor at Chalkbeat. Appreciate the time on Studio 2.
Absolutely.
And let me read a couple more comments. Jerry from Bala Cynwyd says, I actually studied the person who created Head Start. It's a great program. So sad Trump is trying to defund it. And we should just clarify, if we gave the false impression, there's not been any defunding to date. There is a change in regulation. And Judy on YouTube says, from what I observed, Head Start has been, in general, miles better in quality for children's development than other preschool companies.
Yeah, thank you to everybody who called in today and those of you who commented. Sorry, Jerry from Ballykinwin, we couldn't get to your call today. Hopefully you'll listen again and call in another day. And of course, I got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.